right, welcome to another episode of Piecing It Together, the podcast where we take a look at a new movie and try to figure out what movies inspired it. And today on the show, we are talking about Jim Cummings and PJ McCabe's The Beta Test, which came out on VOD just a couple of weeks ago. Definitely one of my most anticipated movies of this year. I'm a big fan of Jim Cummings and the work he's done so far with Thunder Road and The Wolf of Snow Hollow. The Wolf of Snow Hollow, which we actually covered here on Piecing It Together a while back, so you should check out that episode as well. But yeah, I'm always excited to see what Jim Cummings is going to do, and this is his new film. And joining me is Q, David Quiñones, from my other podcast, Bird Road. We had a great time talking about this movie, and I think we had a lot of really good puzzle pieces to talk about here. So that is coming up in a moment. Before we get to it, I do want to remind you, as always, to make sure you're subscribed to Piecing It Together on your podcast app of choice. You can rate and review us over on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser. You could also rate and review us on Good Pods as well, and follow us on social media at Piecing Pod. We also have a Facebook group, Popcorn and Puzzle Pieces, where we continue the conversation about all the movies we talk about here on the show. And lastly, we also have the Produced by David Rosen Patreon, where I post advanced content from Piecing It Together, as well as bonus content from Awesome Movie Year, bonus content from my music career, all kinds of good stuff. Check it out, patreon.com/bydavidrosen. And with that said, you know, we've got a long episode coming up for you, so let's just get to it. And I do want to mention, last week on Bird Road, my lawn guy made a whole bunch of racket outside the window during the recording session, and he seems to have flown across the country to wreak havoc on Piecing It Together this time by going outside of Q's window out there in Miami. So there is some noise in the background of the episode, but you know, it's fine. I think it still sounds pretty good, and we got a great conversation, so let's get to it now. Q is with me today. It's been Hell a while yeah. since he's been on the show.
Too long.
Q, how are you doing?
Not good.
We were going to do a Bird Road this morning, but it didn't happen. But, yeah, you know.
Too much happening, man. It's, you know,
yeah.
It's like it's life, she passes you by. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah. Quickly, before we get into the beta test, let's recap the news. What should we talk about? I'm just kidding. Let's
recapitulate for all of your listeners who are so tuned in
yes.
to current events. That they're listening to a podcast about various movies and the movies that make up those movies. Yeah.
They got their finger on the pulse always, for sure. All right, let's talk about the beta test. I was really looking forward to this movie, and I know you, like me, have recently become a big Jim Cummings fan.
Thanks to you.
Yeah.
You turned me on to Jim Cummings, and
absolutely.
He's awesome. He's a great creator.
Yeah, so I know you were looking forward to this as well. You just got to watch it the other day. We'll get into a bunch of puzzle pieces along the way, but we might as well just get this out in front here. Is Jim Cummings like kind of the most exciting new independent filmmaker right now? Like, does he kind of have all the attention? It seems, you know, like
as we tried to get into like these different puzzle pieces, and there was one puzzle piece that I couldn't quite figure out, which was I wanted to find somebody who was a Jim Cummings at this point in the past. Mm. And there's going to be a lot of filleting Jim Cummings in this episode, because we both love him a lot. But
sure.
I will say, and I don't mean this in this like fawning, overly complimentary way. I mean it in a very brass tacks kind of way. I can't think of anybody that's like him that seems not just comfortable operating in this independent status, but seems like that's the goal. The goal is for him to see like how big of a thing he can do with how little. And we'll get into the themes of the movie, but I was trying to come up with somebody else who maybe early in their career intentionally painted themselves as such a sort of a system outsider or studio outsider, somebody who just had that drama kid energy that was very much like, I just want to make this with my friends and people that I like. And I don't know. I couldn't find anybody who has had sort of the, and don't get me wrong, like none of his movies that have like, you know, had like enormous box office returns or anything. Like
sure.
That. He's not that kind of director, but I couldn't come up with anybody who was not just at this point in their life. This wasn't just a stepping stone for them. He seems right. like he's setting up shop in this space of like
yeah.
of indie DIY you know, the Cummings expanded universe one day will be a bunch of like really, you know, Pete Rose type of movies where they make a lot out of a little, you know, and,
sure.
And I think that that's interesting. I was trying to find, I don't know. Can you think of somebody who maybe you have a puzzle piece of like, oh, well, this was the last, you know, indie movie that this director did before, you know, he got, you know, Lionsgate gave him $10 million to make something. And
right. That's the thing that kind of like steps on any possibilities that I would have thought of, because yeah. And you would definitely have to go back to like the '70s or something for somebody that might even come close to, you know, being that kind of a person. But because yeah, nowadays everybody, they start maybe in something small and indie, but they definitely work their way up into these bigger Hollywood things. And granted, you know, The Wolf of Snow Hollow was, you know, a studio movie, but still yeah. very small by comparison. I mean, he's definitely...
You and I heard...
I don't think he would take the Marvel call, maybe. No.
I mean...
I don't think he would.
I don't know. That's such a weird supposition, because, like, I don't know. There's a whole logic behind that. Like the whole, and a lot of it is mythical. Like the
yeah.
one for me, one for them, which if you ever like follow that logic out, it doesn't ever work out that way. There's never one for me, one for them. There aren't really one for me, one for them guys. Like,
mm-hmm.
even though they say that there are, you know, because you get so wrapped up in all that IP big studio stuff. And you and I heard the same interview with him recently on another podcast where he was talking about how, I mean, I was kind of reading between the lines. It sounded like he was really uncomfortable with the Wolf of Snow Hollow. Not necessarily the story, which was his and some other people and the creators he was working with, but the size of it. It seemed like he didn't
right.
thrive. He wasn't his best self in this. And it was Wolf of Snow Hollow was not a big budget production or anything like that.
No.
But on that interview that I'm talking about, he said that it was 10 times the size of his first feature, Thunder Road. It was
yeah.
in terms of budget, which you can see. It's got some CGI and some animation and some studio elements to it that you wouldn't see in an indie, right? That interview sounded like a guy who was really happy working and trying to like find the cheat code to make big budget looking movies out of micro budgets. And yeah. And I don't know. It's like you can probably find a lot of filmmakers. Like, I don't know. What was the story about what Reservoir Dogs cost Tarantino, right? Like nothing, right? right? But I mean, like the minute that Tarantino had access to greater amounts of capital to make, I don't know. What was the first thing that he probably spent a lot of money on? Probably Jackie Brown, right? I mean, Pulp Fiction couldn't have cost much except for like
right.
music rights. I don't know. Like, Jackie
well, I mean,
Brown
I'm
was,
sure it was a sizable jump, though. Like,
Jackie
especially
Brown had
compared
a lot of
Reservoir
exteriors
Dogs.
And like public place shots in L.A. I mean, like
yeah.
they shot in like forget the name, but that big mall in L.A. that costs like $5 million to shoot at that they shoot everything at in L.A. You know, like I think about like you could have made 3 Jim Cummings movies for the bag handoff scene in Jackie Brown, like the
sure.
budget of that. And I think that he's happy that way. And so I didn't really want to like try to find. Oh, now look, this week it's me with the
your lawn guy.
So anyway, I didn't want to find. I didn't think that it would be accurate to say that it's a puzzle piece. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I didn't think that would be the case.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. It is definitely difficult to find somebody in that particular trajectory. And you know, by the way, who would love to stick with indies but make an actual career out of it? This guy
you,
right here,
yeah,
David Rosen, composing music. I feel like the day I get the call to compose a music for like a King Kong movie, it would be the biggest hassle. I mean, it's the dream, but it would be
well,
such
all,
a hassle
super...
every step of the way.
It's super corporate. I mean, if you're not the director, if you're not the showrunner or the, you know, the principal, the lead managing principal of a project, if you're a composer, it turns into a corporate job. Like it's
yes.
and like a lot of email, a lot of back and forth. It sucks the creativity out of the process.
TPS reports on my music.
TPS reports. Yeah, like exactly. It's going to be like you're everything's going to be analyzed and fixed cost. And like you're going to have like a whole slew of boring elements that you didn't get into this world to do. Like you didn't get into making music to do that shit.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's start getting into some puzzle pieces here. What do you have for your first puzzle piece for the beta test?
Dave, this is a movie that you and I first saw, but not in a movie theater. We randomly saw it on, I think we found it on like DVD. It was a very This is a very obscure movie, and I'm not even sure if you could find it in very many places. This movie is called Employee of the Month. Now, a lot of people are going to think that this is the Dane Cook, I think Jessica Simpson vehicle or somebody, I forget, whoever was the hot girl of that moment. Not that Employee of the Month. The Employee of the Month is the one that was directed by Mitch Rouse, starring Matt Dillon, Steve Zahn, Christina Applegate, came out in 2004. It features Matt Dillon as the, you know, titular Employee of the Month, who gets fired on his day at right after becoming Employee of the Month from his job at the bank, and proceeds to enter this spiral where he, you know, the character that we meet at the beginning of the movie is this very straight-laced guy, and they use a few visual cues to let you know that he is maybe a little more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. The most obvious one is that he has scars, and you don't know where he got these scars from. I don't know if you remember this movie or not, Dave.
But I forgot about it until now, but it's a great movie to include in this, but continue with your description of it.
Yeah, so as you continue to learn more about David, who is the character that Matt Dillon plays, we learn that he has a very dark, sordid past. He's suppressing a lot. He is trying to be something that, you know, he's a victim of imposter syndrome. He knows that what he's doing and the parts of his life that he's building up, this marriage that he's about to enter. Again, another situation where we're talking about a Southern California couple who are trying to, plan their nuptials amidst some, you know, turmoil. It's a lot of it's bullshit. It's ultimately bullshit. The life that he's trying to build for himself, and he knows it, and he's fighting against that. And I'm not going to say this was a great movie. Beta Test is a far superior movie. But it has its moments. Steve Zahn is dialed up, like mid 2000s, like coked out of his mind. Steve Zahn has some scenes that are a little tough to watch, but a lot that's funny and really good. And so Employee of the Month, starring Matt Dillon. Right at the tail end of that Matt Dillon moment, right?
Yeah, like, he was a thing for like a minute, gone.
For a little while. From like, I would say like 97 to like 2004, he was a thing.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So
absolutely. Yeah. You know what? So I completely forgot about that movie. And that is a great piece to bring up, because when I'm making my list of puzzle pieces, sometimes I'll have a spot in my notes document where I'll write down like an idea or a theme and try to fill it in later with a movie. And this time I couldn't think of a movie who's spiraling out, but it's all his fault. He's the asshole.
And do you know what the specific moment was for me where I was like, okay, I did the same thing where I was like, I want to find a movie that has something like this, where we see Jim Cummings' characters, where he like pulls his cheek back and we see the back molars where the white strip doesn't touch, where the whitening strips don't touch, and they're just corroded and rotten. And that's a great metaphor, I think, for like him and for his soul. It's that too is also a little heavy handed, but it's good. I like it. And it's very similar to when we first see Matt Dillon's character without his shirt on. And we're like, okay, well, we saw these neck scars and these sort of facial scars on him, but then we really see that there's something damaged about this man. There's something fucked up, something in his past, something happened to him. And he's trying to overcome it, trying to hide it, but not really dealing with it. And I was like, did the same thing that you're talking about, where I was like, let me think of a movie where something similar like that happens. And I felt that was the same. I don't know if you remember that detail of Employee of the Month. You and I watched it drunk on a couch.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah. And I definitely don't, but good piece to start it off with.
Good hot couch movie. Good hot couch movie.
For sure. I'll go to my first piece, and that is going to be Paul Thomas Anderson's Punch Drunk Love. First one that I thought of with this, as this kind of schmucky guy does something for himself that's sexual in nature that, of course, doesn't work out well. In that case, we've got Adam Sandler's character talking to this phone sex line and kind of figures, you know, other people do this. Why can't I do this? He shouldn't have, and it doesn't work out well, and everything just goes awful and from bad to worse. And here, Jordan's character is doing something much worse, of course, actually cheating on his fiance, but at the same time, it's kind of the same trajectory of something sexual spiraling out of control and leading towards all of this anxiety and, everything that goes on from there.
Yeah, like Jeopardy and Guilt. right? It's you go from jeopardy to guilt in both of those. And there are also moments in both of those movies where both of the main characters kind of get tired of feeling the guilt over the thing that they did, and they become angry instead, and they start to like go from trying to like fix the problem to like lashing out against it and fighting it. So, which I think that Punch Drunk Love is an incredible movie, an all timer. But what it does, where it shows that descent into like paranoia and worry. And also, I don't know what you call it when you're worried that a thing will happen, when you have anxiety over doing something, and then you do it, and the worst thing happens.
Right.
The thing you were worried about.
That it's you a got very taken Jewish for a ride. Thing, by the way.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So that's a great one. Yeah. Paul Thomas. And also another Hugh and George David movie that we watched together. Yeah.
Absolutely. So, what do you got for your next piece?
I'm going to steal from you. I know that you have this one lined up. I know that it's sitting there in your back pocket, and I know that you're going to try to deploy it, but I'm going to steal it from you. 1991's Barton Fink.
Nice.
Which is a skewering of Hollywood through the eyes of, I think probably, I don't know much about the movie Barton Fink. Like I know a lot of the backstory behind like Lebowski and Fargo and what else? I've read all types of, articles and posts and stuff about the, Burn After Reading, which I find to be a fascinating movie, Blood Simple also, but I don't know. I've never, and the Coen brothers are obviously famously tight-lipped. They'll tell you that that none of their movies mean anything. Don't read anything into any of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's hard to watch this movie knowing that the Coen brothers had great critical success in 1991. The Coen brothers had two critical successes, but weren't quite at that point yet where they were going to be, they weren't the Coen brothers yet. Right. I mean, they weren't at that point. And I would imagine that there was some sort of outsidery, like, look at how perverse this industry is that we're trying to get into. Look at how horrible it is. Look at the people that populate it and the things that you have to do to be a part of this industry, the things that you have to be okay with to be a part of this industry. Or it will kill you. It will literally, and like again, a lot of the sort of psychological tension that they imbue is throughout Barton Fink is similar to what Jim Cummings does. In a lot of that, he uses a lot of editing tricks and a lot of sort of narrative stuff to infuse that tension into the beta test, and ultimately. These two main characters are dealing with the same thing. They are trying to find where they fit in this corrupt industry without being corrupt themselves. But they are because the ultimate message is that you will be corrupted. Like there's no way to succeed without that.
Yeah. It's also equal parts, a love letter to that industry that they know is exactly. So awful. But they love it anyway because it's terrible. It's the best.
Yeah, I will say I will draw one line of distinction though is that I feel like Jim Cummings has a very finely tuned blade when it comes to exactly what he thinks is wrong with modern day Hollywood. And again, Barton Fink is it's 1991, but it's a period piece. I believe it's set in the mid '60s, right, in the mid to late '60s. So. Jim Cummings has a really clear understanding of, like, if you watch this movie, you see what he thinks is not working in Hollywood. The agency model, the representation, the hangers-on, what you might consider to be sort of barnacles of the industry, people who are just money changers, money movers. Sorry for the trope, Dave. But the money changers in the temple, the people who are just kind of taking value and moving it around and just saying like, oh, well, I'll take a little bit off of the top and not really bringing anything to the table creatively. And he gets called out in the beginning of the movie by, I think it was like a director, right? Or like some sort of like hotshot, big deal studio head or something like that, who tells him exactly that, like, you're not adding anything, you're nothing, you're dying. And we're all glad that you're all dying. We love that you're dying. You guys are pieces of shit. And Barton Fink gets shit on in much a similar way as, this ingenue writer who is trying to like define himself in that era. It's different, but it's the same.
Yeah. So I actually didn't have Barton Fink on my list, although I definitely thought of it. I've got one that goes right along with it, though. 1992, The Player, Robert Altman, another Hollywood satire, another look behind the scenes of Hollywood into not the acting world, but the business side of it and everything that goes on behind the scenes with writers, with directors or producers, all that. And of course, you know, a whole mystery, a rabbit hole for the main character to kind of go down after receiving a letter in his mailroom. And then things kind of spiral out of control from there. You also get lots of kind of not parody, but like these descriptions of ridiculous sounding Hollywood-y projects, kind of like the All Dog remake Jordan is talking about in the beta test. Yeah. This is a very obvious piece here, The Player. I actually hadn't seen it until last week. I finally watched it.
I've never seen it.
Oh, it's so, so good. It's probably the best movie I've watched this year. I'm so glad that the beta test brought me to it, and you should definitely watch it. I think you'll love it.
So what that reminds me of, I don't have an opinion on that movie, unfortunately. I haven't seen it, but I will check it out. But it reminds me of, like, if you go back and watch some of the descriptions of, like, the fake shows that they talk about in 30 Rock, and then, like, a bunch of those shows are, like, getting made.
Yeah, pretty much.
Like, I think about that because just a few days ago was the Disney, Upfronts? What were they doing? They were, like, announcing, like, a bunch of new shows, right?
Oh, yeah, just, like, a dozen things. I forget what it was called, Disney Day or something, Disney Plus Day.
Whatever. They just take their upfronts and they make it into, they eventize it. And all of these, like, ridiculous shows where it's like, okay, I guess that's Disney IP now. It's like Daredevil's college professor or some shit like that. And you're just like, okay, I guess we're watching a show about that.
Well, yeah, they just announced Tracy Morgan is going to be in Triplets with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Fucking Christ.
Danny DeVito. I mean, come on.
Jesus fucking Christ on a cracker.
That's right out of 30 Rock. But what do you got next, though?
Making fun of IP, I'm actually going to turn to IP next. And, you know, I wanted to just kind of broadly talk about this filmmaker, and I wanted to talk about this one tendency, a more latter day, more recent tendency of this huge blockbuster filmmaker. Something that he's done that I think that Jim Cummings leveraged in a smart way, and I like to see it done well more and more often. Let me cut the preamble and cut right to it. The movie that I'm talking about is 2012's The Dark Knight Rises, and made by Christopher Nolan. Around this time, Christopher Nolan started doing this thing in his movies, and he's done it more frequently in Tenet and some more recent fare. But he does this move, Dave, where he will thread together these, like, disparate scenes with an unbroken score. Like, the score stays the same, even though we quickly, with no transition, we go from a scene where a character, in the case of Dark Knight Rises, a character is in Southeast Asia and then is in, you know, the Mid-Atlantic region in a matter of a second.
Yeah,
like, he's escaping from a prison and literally walking into Gotham City while the same score is playing, while the same track is playing. And that I thought that Jim Cummings made... Why are they... There isn't even... Dave, there isn't even leaves here. He's leaf blowing my porch.
I don't even know that guy.
I don't even know this man. Whatever. Jim Cummings uses this trick, whatever you would call it, this style, this film, to great success in creating, like, propulsive forward motion, right?
Sure.
There's nothing quiet or static. Right, because we're always being moved from scene to scene to scene. He's on the street. He's yelling at somebody. He's pretending to be an FBI agent and a police officer in the same scene sometimes.
Sure.
And, like, to the same person, like, lying about being an FBI agent and a police officer, which I think is brilliant. Another funny thing I love about this movie is that he never really gets caught for doing that.
Yeah.
Like, he just gets away with doing that.
Yeah.
I think it's hilarious. So, anyway... Why pick, like, a $500 million Christopher Nolan movie to compare this to?
Well, I mean, everyone's seen it.
So. That editing scheme, I think, is effective. And I thought that Christopher Nolan, people hated that, I think, about Dark Knight Rises, where it was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. He was just in, you know, Afghanistan. And now he's, you know, and he had a broken back. And then, like, it's a year. how long are we supposed to think that was, that it took his back to heal? Like a year and a half?
You know what's a great example of that trick, though? I recently rewatched Napoleon Dynamite, and when he's asking him if he has a, he asks Pedro if he has a bike, and then they're outside looking at his bike. Like,
he's like, this is it. Yeah. Brilliant. I love it. I love that. That's awesome. What's your next one, Dave?
Yeah, no, that's a good piece, though. I just want to say, because like I do think that that kind of speaks to the economical nature of the way that Jim Cummings works. I mean, for such a cheap amount, he makes this movie look good, and I think that's using those kind of tricks as part of that. But I'll use for my next piece one of your favorite movies of the last few years, and that is Under the Silver Lake.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, I know you love that movie, but another, you know, conspiracy-based movie.
I might
movie.
Watch that again today. I might
you
watch
should,
that.
And,
you just
and
said
I
it.
Should watch it. I've only seen it the one time, and I really That's liked crazy. It, and I've been wanting to rewatch it. But
that movie is a pure vibe. It's just vibe. Yeah, you turn it on, and it's just you're just vibing, yeah.
It is, absolutely. And, you know, you were just talking about him impersonating the police officer and the FBI officer, but it's like just the rabbit hole this guy goes down of just uncovering thing after thing, and do we even know by the end what of it is, you know, how to make heads or tails of really any of it, barely, like just little bits and pieces of it. It's just so, it's anxiety, really, you know, and it's conspiracy and anxiety and all of that thrown on this poor guy who, as we establish, isn't really a poor guy. He's kind of an asshole and kind of deserves it.
Right. And what's funny too, is you're talking about two movies where there is, I don't know, use your literary device, whether it's Sword of Damocles or it's like, you know, the Chekhov's gun, where certain Chekhov's guns or Swords of Damocles, like they don't ever fall. Like he's forever, like one of the sort of narrative drivers there is that he's about to get evicted. And then he just does.
Yeah.
And that's it. Yeah. It's like, okay, I guess that happened now. And it's like, just like it's like if one of those like goofy campy 80s movies where it was like, oh, we need to raise $1,000 or the ski school is gonna close, then it's like, damn, we never bothered to go raise that money, the ski school closed, and it's just like, well, that's
on
that.
To the next thing.
I guess bye. It reminds me of, honestly, it reminds me of Dirty Work, the last line of Dirty Work, where it's like, except for Dr. Farthing, The mob beat him to death anyway, so he's dead. Bye.
Bye. Rest in peace, Norm MacDonald. All right, what do you got next?
Dave, I got two. Let me ask you. You want a 90s classic problematic movie that nobody wants to talk about anymore? Or would you rather have something a little bit more contemporary, starring and with a lead from probably our favorite television show of all time?
Oh boy, I kind of want them both, though. Can I get them both?
Yeah. Which one do you want first?
Let's go with the 90s one first.
Okay, good. The 90s movie that I want to talk about is 1993's Falling Down, starring Michael Douglas.
Sure.
Which is a far more severe portrayal of a man falling apart, a man who has achieved some level of success and along with it, some level of entitlement, who thinks that the world owes him something, who thinks that the world has all of these problems and he is the upright sort of the foil of the world. He's the one who's saying like, what's right and what's wrong, and he's got it all figured out until the very end of the movie, where again, our main characters both realize they didn't know anything. They had it wrong the whole time. They fucked everything up in their life, and it's their own fault. And of course, this was directed, probably the best Joel Schumacher movie. I don't know. What do you got any hot takes on Joel Schumacher? Or?
I don't have any hot takes on Joel Schumacher, but as far as this movie is concerned, I've only seen it once, and it was back when it first came out. And I've been wanting to revisit it. And I was actually thinking about this as the example of the guy spiraling, thinking it's everybody else's fault, but really he's the asshole. This was kind of the one I was leaning towards if I was going to use it.
Right. Yeah. It's funny because through this, I mean, like this movie was problematic. People, and again, only in the last 10 years have we started using language like problematic, but like this movie was that in the 90s. It's not like the 90s were like the 19th century or something. I mean, it was still not okay to like beat Korean people, you know, to do hate crimes to Korean people in the stores that they own. Like, it was not okay to do that in 1993. Marky Mark. It was still not okay to do that. But
coming in hot for Marky Mark on
Piecing It Together. Well, he did that. He did. That's what I think that opening scene is based on, where Michael Douglas gets tired of being in traffic and beats up a Korean guy in his store. There's all types of problems with this movie, but through the lens of it's one of those things where it's like a what do they call that, horseshoe theory, where it's like we almost come all the way back around to the point where we can watch it again to critique it, you know. But yeah, it's got all types of problems. The main character is a fuck up, and again believes that the whole world owes him something, and
right.
It's one of my, I used to love that movie when I was a kid, and I loved it for all the wrong reasons.
I'm sure. Yeah. No, I really do want to rewatch that soon. It seems like something worth reevaluating at this point, and especially with everything nowadays, it just seems like it would be a worthwhile watch.
If you watch it, you have to watch it through. And I'll say this, I don't want to come across as like a falling down apologist. I'm not. But it was one of my favorite movies when I was a younger guy, when I was like a teenager. And I will say that you have to watch it through the lens of the 90s, 80s and 90s crime panic that we had. We had a panic in this country where we thought that like evil thugs, like Latino and black thugs, were going to take over our streets. And it was racist, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't an overtly racist Klan type of racism. It was more of a like scary orientalism, you know, worried about the unknown threat of different looking people who were, which, like, don't get me wrong, still fucking racist.
Still sounds anything. A little racist.
It's still super fucking racist. But it's racist in this way that is actually way more pernicious and way more dangerous, if you think about it. Because what
the people that don't realize what they're doing.
Yeah. And signing on to, and don't forget, like that mentality that fed the movie Falling Down, it also the mentality that had very real life consequences, like the Clinton crime bill, which, you know, happened at the exact same time that this movie was coming out, at the exact same time that white suburbanites around this country were getting terrified of the things that were portrayed in this movie, like roving gangs of brown people that might, like, you know, pull a switchblade on you in a park because you wanted to like take a piss or something like that. Like, that I would say is even more dangerous than, at least with somebody in the KKK, they put a hood on and you can identify them and be like, look, there's the racist guy right there. And like, this is way more pernicious. I still think it's worthy. It's a great film. As a film, it's a very good film.
Right.
And it's worthy of revisiting and rewatching, understanding, I think to call it like to call it tone deaf is a bit like letting it slide,
right?
Just understanding the context. Like, it was 1993. We were passing laws to put generations of black people behind bars for a really long time, and that is the context that begat this movie. None of that stuff is at play. Interestingly enough, there is a lot of social commentary in the beta test.
Well, I was going to say, like, this is kind of a big tangent here, but, the beta test, of course, is, a commentary on Me Too and everything happening right now. So to your puzzle piece, Falling Down, do you think a commentary in the style of Falling Down on, violence against minorities, like anything like that, could even work right now?
Well, I think this, to answer your question, I think 30 years from now, I think we'll probably still be talking about Jim Cummings, but we might not be talking about the beta test specifically. We might be talking about whatever ends up being his main opus, right? Whatever his big thing is. So I think 30 years from now, when you look at movies like the beta test, I think that it's the driver of the conversation is going to be a thing that you and I talk about a lot, the pendulum. We're going to start talking about, there's going to be some Aziz Ansari type character, type person, type of individual who gets absolutely ruined, right? Because of not even an accusation, just the tone of the moment. Again, Falling Down wasn't a specific thing like, oh, well, he beat up a Korean guy. He fought back against some, Latino stereotypical gang members. It was, it's not that. It's the tone. And that tone is going to be something that I think when the pendulum swings back, which it will.
Yeah.
When that hypothetical, you know, person gets their career ruined because of something that they didn't really do or isn't really career ruinable or cancelable or whatever, that we'll look back at movies like this and be like, damn, we were really all kind of, were we really all brainwashed in that moment? Because like you can look back at Falling Down and be like, damn, this country was fucking brainwashed in that moment. We were terrified, hiding inside of our houses. And will we look back, and I don't know what the answer is, honestly,
sure,
but will we look back at movies like The Beta Test and be like, damn, that was a real moment there where we like, we swung too far. We were like, you know, and I'm not saying that Jim Cummings necessarily did that in this movie. He didn't. I thought he struck a good tone.
Right.
But yeah. I think that it might be something that's a little unrecognizable to people 30 years from today.
Yeah, that's interesting. That is definitely interesting. I'll go to another piece here, and it's kind of a surface-level piece, but I'm going to go with American Psycho because of the fakeness of the whole corporate world and the total fake smiles and every relationship just being a transaction, and people are only worth what they can do for you and all that. And that this is, of course, the Hollywood version of that. It's all the same kinds of people that are, you know, just completely shallow, and it's all just transactional relationships.
Is there anybody whose characters, the various characters that he plays, gives a more chilling fake smile than Jim Cummings an actor? When absolutely. He gives that fake smile where he's dead behind the eyes,
oh yeah,
and he's like, you can just see the pain on the other side of his face, but he's smiling.
It makes you wonder when he realized he had that. Like, what point did he just recognize that he could do that? You know?
Could do that. That's like so unsettling. It's one of the most unsettling actor traits of anybody. But I say that because Christian Bale, I think, evinced that very well in American Psycho, which obviously is a classic movie.
Oh, yeah. Two Christian Bale movies on our list so far. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's right.
So you got one more piece, right?
I got one more piece, Dave. And I want to take you back to the early to mid 2010s, back when our favorite television show, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. was probably at its apex and has waned in popularity since then. Only the true heads like me and you are still watching it, but back then it was a pretty popular show, and everybody was talking about it. All the show, it was Nightman, you know, all this shit.
Uh-huh.
Like everybody was like making the It's Always Sunny, you know, jokes in pop culture, and in that moment, There was a moment where the cast, people started wondering, huh, what if we take these guys and try and do something else with them?
Mm.
Mostly didn't work out.
Sure.
Mostly, other than Danny DeVito, mostly has not worked out. Although I do love Mythic Quest. I don't know if I've ever mentioned that on the show before. I think Mythic Quest is a great show.
Yeah.
And people tell me that AP Bio is a very good show too, but I'm probably never going to watch that. I didn't like Horrible Bosses. But in this Horrible Bosses era, there was a movie that came out that was a vehicle for Glenn Howerton. It was called Coffee Town. And I don't know if you ever saw this movie or not, Dave. It was a comedy. It was directed by Brad Copeland. It also starred Jake Johnson was in it. Okay. And Adrian Palicki. And this movie came out in 2013. It was meant as a Glenn Howerton vehicle. Glenn Howerton basically plays like a struggling like website manager, a web developer, basically like a tech guy. But he was work from home before work from home became the coin of the realm, as it were. And he had a coffee town, which is like a stand-in for Starbucks, basically, that he would spend all of his time in. And the rumors of the other losers that spend their time at this coffee bar became that, you know, it became known that this coffee bar was about to close and be turned into an actual bar. And the movie is basically 90 minutes of hijinks around him sort of falling apart. And he has like this unreasonable connection to that bar. He can't do his work anywhere else but there. And so if it turns into a bar, it could be very detrimental to his career. Stakes, again, one thing I think was interesting about this movie, it's actually a pretty funny movie. I really liked it. It's really good. But one of the things that I thought was interesting about this movie are the stakes, where they feel so big, right? But ultimately, they're nothing. The stakes are nothing. Like, if you look at what was the worst thing that could have happened in the beta test, we're shown that this guy's fledgling agency is on the verge of shuttering,
right,
because of CAA and UTA, I forget, whatever.
It's probably going to shut down, though, whatever it is.
It's going to shut down. But then you see, like, what that means. Is that going to be a bunch of people losing their jobs? It's like 7 or 8 people in a conference room who look like they don't want to be there. Right. And I think that that was a choice by Jim Cummings to be like, well, let's show the bereft emptiness of, like, what the world that this guy has built. He owns this agency, and what is it? It's like a handful of, like, people who do not care about their work, who actively hate him,
yeah,
who, you know. And similarly, the stakes are minuscule in Coffee Town. The stakes are one Starbucks might change its business model and turn into like an ultra lounge or something like that. And then the thing that, again, and this is spoilers, I know that you give a spoiler warning up front because we're talking about a movie and we're, yeah, like breaking it down and dissecting it, but spoiler alert, the worst thing happens. That's what happens. It turns into a bar at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And when I beta test, all the worst possible things happen for Jim Cummings. There's some moments of triumph or some moments of revelation or whatever, where he's like a catharsis, I guess. Great. Like, that's the climax, kind of like what you would consider to be like the literary climax. But where he has these moments of catharsis, but like, for the most part, he just loses.
Yeah.
He doesn't get the things that he wants. Like, it doesn't work out, and he's in worse shape than he was at the beginning of the movie, at the end of the movie. So 2013's Coffee Town. I don't even know where you could find this movie if you want to watch it. But
yeah, apparently I just looked it up, and apparently it was College Humor's first movie.
Oh, that's right. I wonder if I did not realize that.
Does that still exist? College Humor?
College Humor.
The many Hollywood grasps, like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, like, what, if it doesn't exist, then what are all the comedians who live in LA, like, actually watching?
Yeah.
Because that's all that collegehumor.com was made for, is for other comedians to watch.
Yeah, and watch each other.
Watch each other and just shit on each other. And just be like, I fucking hate this. You suck.
You know? This is terrible. I hate it. Kind of feels like podcasting, actually.
That reminds me of, like, something that you must, that would, like, make your skin crawl. The scene from, it was Funny People, where Jonah Hill's character does the cut of him with the cats, like playing with, it's like cats playing and then him acting like a cat.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, and then I just linked to my website and a million people come. And that, like, must piss you off so much. Just the idea of that, like, anything, any kind of practical gimmick or anything like that pisses you off for people to promote their work and actually, uh-huh, and for it to work.
Yeah.
That must piss you off so much. What your listeners don't realize is that Dave's thing is like, no, you just make the thing and then put it out there and then no one listens to it. And that's how it is. That's, and I'm like, well, what about, you know, marketing? What about if I put you in a little cat video and you're playing with, no.
Why should I have to do that?
I'm already making the music. Why do I have to pretend to be a cat? It's like, well, nobody's going to listen to your fucking music, Dave, unless you pretend to be a cat.
Is that what you're saying? If I do the cat video, that they'll come?
Look, I think you're getting hung up on the cat video thing.
All right, I got one last puzzle piece. I could have easily went with Eyes Wide Shut for the private sex club stuff, but I'm going to go a little bit more basic and go 50 Shades of Grey for the puzzle piece here.
I haven't seen this.
Yeah. Well, I've only seen the first one. It's terrible.
There were more than one?
There are three of them. It's like a big trilogy.
51 Shades?
It's an epic trilogy. But yeah, I mean, basically the, you know, the attitudes towards sex in media are so just like out there right now, you know, and it kind of takes like kinky stuff. And it's funny because of the whole Me Too era and everything, we're kind of living this world between kink shaming and embracing kinks. And, you know, like, there's the whole scene where Jim Cummings is like filling out his card of what he wants his encounter to include. And that's played for laughs. But at the same time, this guy, you know, clearly wants what he wants. And so I think there's a lot of that current attitude towards sex that is like a really kind of a lot of it, I think for some people, kind of came from those books and those movies, which is just ridiculous, but that is what kind of put it in the pop culture and put it in the zeitgeist.
So what you're saying is you're drawing a line between the 50 Shades of Grey, like weird kink behind closed doors, like tie you up, blindfold shit,
yeah,
and that situation, that specific plot line that the main character finds,
and for putting that in a movie as the central, you know, jumping off point for the movie.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I can see that. Yeah. That's good. I'm only familiar with that IP, honestly, like through its like popular representations.
Exactly.
Consumed any of it. I haven't watched any of it or read any of it. I know that they're very, very popular books. And
I promise they were you don't need to watch the movies.
But they were like, the cool thing about those books is that like that's like the most successful fan fiction ever, right? Isn't that what the idea is?
It was a Twilight fan fiction, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah. That's what I've heard too.
That's insane.
Which is great. I think that's cool.
If, yeah.
You know, fan fiction makes it. I'm sure that I probably wouldn't. It's probably not my cup of tea. But yeah. It's great. That's cool. Dave. I just want to go back and like revisit Coffee Town really quick because I like scrolled down the IMDb page. Listen to this cast along with Glenn Howerton, who we both love.
Yeah.
And Jake Johnson, who I think we both love. I love Jake Johnson.
Yeah, he's good.
He's incredible. Him. Ben Schwartz,
mm-hmm.
Matt Walsh, Josh Groban is in this movie. Everybody in this movie is hilarious. Steve Little. Is there anybody better than Steve Little?
Steve Little rules.
Do you know who Brian Husky is?
I've heard that name before.
If you Google him, you'll know him. He's in everything funny. He's like he's just like the like middling, like nebbishy, you know, bald middle-aged guy.
Mm-hmm.
Derek Waters plays his roommate in a very small part. Kristen Quick, who is like that really crazy redhead with the big eyes and is like always like if you look her up, you know who she is immediately. She's hilarious.
Oh yeah, Brian Husky. I know exactly that. Yeah, he was on Children's Hospital.
He was on Children's Hospital. Yeah. I wasn't sure what I could bring up that would make you like remember or think of him, you know. But so anyway, that's what a fucking cast. What a loaded
I gotta watch
cast.
That. I definitely have to watch that.
So yeah, you should check it out. It's a good one to kind of catch up on.
All right, so our finished puzzle for the beta test, we got Employee of the Month, Punch Drunk Love, Barton Fink, The Player, The Dark Knight Rises, Under the Silver Lake, Falling Down, American Psycho, Coffee Town, and 50 Shades of Grey. Really interesting, wide-ranging list. I mean,
what do you think Jim Cummings would say about this list?
I'm really curious, too. I mean, you know, there's a couple of obvious ones on here, I think, but... I think he'd be particularly interested in some of the, you know, like talking about his crazy eyes and stuff like that. That would be an interesting thing to hear what his thought would be on. But yeah, I think talking about Jim Cummings is kind of the central point of this episode, really, it feels like. It feels like we've talked about him so much throughout all these puzzle pieces.
Yeah.
He is the center of this movie and of all of his movies.
Yeah, I mean that's what happens when you have like it's the auteur thing, right? I mean like
right.
Everything is seen through this guy's eyes in these movies. And that's great because he has an incredible perspective. He sees things. You know, what I'm worried about with Jim Cummings, Dave, is when he reaches a level of success where he's not starring in the movies anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard him on that same interview that we talked about at the top of the show. I heard him talking about his next project and that he is casting it and he's not casting himself.
Right.
And I'm sure it'll be great. I'm sure it's going to be good. And, but from the first time I played that first scene of Thunder Road, and if you're listening to this show and you haven't checked out Jim Cummings, still very early, you know, back catalog, cause he's a young guy. He's a pretty young dude, I think.
Yeah.
As far as, you know, films go, he's only got those two other big projects. I don't think there are any other
right just the three, and then he was just in Halloween Kills, which was terrible, but he was funny.
He was in the last scene of Dave. He was in the last episode of Dave. He was in the season finale.
Oh, that's right. I haven't watched it yet. I gotta watch it.
Yeah, he was, but he had like five lines. I don't know, but and he wasn't a Jim Cummings character. He was just an actor playing a role. But that very first scene of Thunder Road, the monologue that he gives at his mother's funeral, it's something so special. Like it's so good. And immediately, you know, you're like, this is a guy that's working with some really special shit. And like, I don't know who to compare him to. Like, he's like a very, as an actor, I'm not going to say this as a director, but as an actor or as a person either, I don't want to say this as a person either, but as an actor, he's got this like Woody Allen energy of like kind of being so comfortable in this uncomfortable skin. Like he's so pent up with like pathology. His characters are so like they have like all of this self-doubt and weird narcissism that's been bent inwards on itself in this like twisted imposter syndrome version of like these people who are just falling apart at the seams and just hot messes that but like they're so sad, but they're so compelling and interesting. And
yeah.
You're watching them in the same way that you watch a car accident that's about to happen.
Sure.
And I know that he's, you know, his aspirations, if you ask him what he is, he's a director. He's going to say he's a director. He's a writer and a director. So he's not going to, he's going to achieve some level of success where he's probably not in as many movies in the future being that character. He might get cast to be, because he's a, you know, young, good-looking guy. I'll probably get cast and stuff. But, like, I don't know how much longer he's going to play those characters.
And I think it's important for him to not do that, because he's going to get, you know, typecast himself in that. And then that's when I think the backlash starts, is when he's just doing that over and over again. And so far, it's really 3 for 3. I mean, I've really liked all three of these movies. I would definitely say Thunder Road is the best of the three. But he is still a guy falling apart in all three movies, and I want to see him do something completely different, hopefully.
You know who I'd love to see him play?
Huh?
A young Joe Biden. Wouldn't he be perfect as a young Joe
He'd
Biden?
Be pretty damn good.
Just like pissed off, confused, like the world is like zipping by him and he's not really sure what's happening. And he's just,
is that
like,
how young Joe Biden was? Was he was
young
he...
Joe Biden was, well, young Joe Biden was, yeah, he was like one of these like plain spoken, like it's funny because it's like Joe Biden always tried to, he was like a politician from age 15.
Now I'm picturing Joe Biden in his underwear, just like breaking down in front of a police station.
I would love to see him play young Joe Biden in Delaware trying to like trying to sell a used car, because that's what Joe Biden was doing before he got into politics. He was a used car salesman, and like, and just not being able to sell the car, kind of like a Lester Nygaard moment where it's like, well, you know, the car already comes with the UV protection. It's like, and like, and then just decide, fuck this, I'm running for Congress.
amazing right, Q, is there another movie you watched recently you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
Beta Test is it. No, you know what I'm going to recommend to our listeners is what I was trying to recommend to you recently. It's a 20-hour investment, but you won't be sad that you did it. And that is on Apple TV right now. I think that, and it's funny because if you watch the Beta Test, you probably watched it on Apple TV, because I think that's kind of like the only place you can watch it right now.
Yeah, I think it's spreading out to the other VODs soon, or it might have just this past weekend, but yes.
Okay, so if you've already got Apple TV booted up from watching the Beta Test, then you know what? Go on there and watch For All Mankind, which is a cross between, I would say, like, it's Mad Men in space. Mad Men in space. It's about the culture of NASA in the 70s and 80s, the way that it had to change to meet the time. It's about the space race, the chief conceit. It's fictional. It's based on real characters, but it is fictional, because the conceit is that the United States lost the race to the moon to the Russians, to the USSR. And that's the premise. That happens in the first episode right away, right up top. And what happens over the next 20 hours of content is that of show is that, you see what that does to us as a nation, what that does to NASA as a space program, and the way that it drives us in good ways and in bad ways. The way that it furthers this ideological battle between, you know, Marxist-Leninism and capitalism, and the way that that comes to a head in a lot of different ways. It's an incredibly made show. And when I say that it's Mad Men in space, I mean like it's as good as Mad Men. As a TV show, if you liked Mad Men, you'll like this. It has like a lot of different angles to it and elements. There's you know, the sort of melding together of this sort of test pilot, you know, bro culture that was very you know, hyper present at the beginning of NASA, because that's what you needed, crazy ass white boys to get up there and and fly planes and not worry about maybe dying. And then the culture of sort of the nerd, the engineer, the statistician, the mathematician, and the various scientific minds who have to say, okay, well, sure, you'll get the rocket there, but how do you get out? How do you walk around? How do you not die up there? I don't know. I don't want to get too deep into it, man, but check out For All Mankind. I've been trying to get people to watch the show. I think the third season comes out early 2022. You got 20 hours of two seasons of 10 episodes that you can watch right now, and you'll be really fucking glad if you watch this show. It's one of the best, most visually arresting things I've seen. Looks better than Dune. Looks better than any Christopher Nolan shit that you've seen. Looks so good, and the acting performances are something else. That's my reco.
I'm gonna try to get Gina to watch it, because then that means I'll end up watching it. So yeah. Q, do you want to plug anything?
Yeah, I mean, Bird Road is back. We're like three episodes back in. I think two or three episodes back in. You can check out Bird Road Podcast.
We've been doing some good ones. I think it's been it's been really
good.
Is
that what you
think? I think it's great.
That's something you think, huh?
I'm Josh Bell.
And I'm Jason Harrison. We co-host a podcast called Awesome Movie Year.
Each season, we take a look back at an awesome year for movies, which is every year.
We deep dive into these specific years, and we pick out why they were such great years for films. We go over the biggest hits, the biggest flops, the best picture, some personal picks, some cult classics.
Years we've covered in past seasons include 1994, 2003, 1977, and 1984, and we've got all of film history to look forward to. So check us out at awesomemovieyear.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. All right, so I hope you enjoyed that conversation about the beta test. Thank you to Q for joining me on that one. And what can I say? We love that Jim Cummings. Can't wait to see what he does next, and it was a fun one to talk about. If you are enjoying what we're doing here on Piecing It Together, make sure you're subscribed. We got a lot of episodes coming your way. We've got one coming up next week on Finch, also The House of Gucci. Actually, I haven't recorded that one at the time of this going up, but I'm planning on recording this weekend House of Gucci, Licorice Pizza, and Ghostbusters Afterlife, as well as the trailers episode for December. So lots of podcasts coming your way. So make sure you're subscribed wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you really like what we do, share the show with your friends. Share the show on your Twitters and on your Facebooks and wherever else you can share the show. It really, really helps to get us out in front of new people and get new listeners. We've had so many new listeners lately, and I just want to see that number keep going up, because it's awesome. I love doing the show no matter what, but if people are listening, that makes it even better. So thank you for that. You could also follow us, of course, on social media at PiecingPod. Join our Facebook group, Popcorn and Puzzle Pieces, where we continue the conversation about all the movies we talk about here on the show. And, of course, we have our Produced by David Rosen Patreon, which you should check out. And, you know, you could always subscribe over there, too. You don't have to, but if you want to, I'd appreciate it. And as soon as I get back from my honeymoon, I'm going to start posting some of that promised music stuff that I keep saying I'm going to do. I'm really going to do it. Lots of music stuff hitting that Patreon. And there's some of those advanced episodes will be up there any day now as well. So check it out. Produced by David Rosen, Patreon, patreon.com/bydavidrosen. Lastly, make sure you subscribe to Bird Road, because me and Q are back at it, and we have been doing some really fun episodes, and you should definitely be listening to Bird Road. If you like what I do over here on Piecing It Together, check out my other podcast, Bird Road. So let's close this thing out with a piece of music like I always do. And this seems about as good a time as any for me to preview a track from my next album. How about that? This does not have a name yet, although I was thinking about calling it The Mask. So that kind of makes it a good fit for the beta test, doesn't it? With some of those sexy scenes with the sexy sex party masks. But anyway, I don't know why I was going to call this The Mask. It was just the first name that came to mind when I was sitting there listening to this music as I started making it. But the track's not done yet, so I'm letting you hear an unfinished piece of music. I still have more that I plan on doing to it, but I hope you enjoy it in its current state and look forward to whatever my next album ends up being, whenever that ends up being. Of course, I will let you know when it ends up being finished and I start planning the release. I do have some idea in mind of when that will be and what it'll be called and all that stuff, but I'm not going to let you know about that quite yet. But it is coming, and this track will be on it when it does come. So yeah, this is some unreleased music. Enjoy it. We'll be back with more Piecing It Together real soon.
an All Points West production, produced by David Rosen in Las Vegas.